Australia picked a fight with some of the biggest tech companies in the world when it introduced a social media ban for under 16s. And now the government wants to double the penalties for platforms that fail to keep kids off their apps. With fines climbing as high as $99 million and governments overseas watching very closely, will bigger penalties actually change the behaviour of the companies behind Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, TikTok, or are fines like this just another cost of doing business for Silicon Valley's biggest players? My name is Rae Johnston and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Now joining me to unpack some of the biggest stories in tech right now and why they matter, we have Daniel Van Boom, who is a business journalist at Forbes Australia. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thank you for having me.
And also Petra Stock, climate and environment reporter for Guardian Australia. Welcome back, Petra.
Hi, nice to be here.
With the world watching very closely at the moment, the Australian government wants to pass a law doubling the fine for social media companies that aren't complying with the social media ban for under 16s and adding a new $1.6 million fine for failing to hand over information showing that they are actually doing something to keep kids off Instagram and Snapchat and Facebook. Daniel, rewinding, remind me, under the ban, what are social media companies actually required to do?
So they are required to take reasonable steps to prevent kids under 16 years old from using their platforms. That is obviously a pretty broad and vague definition, which was one of the criticisms of the law when it was announced to much fanfare last December. So this new bill, strengthening the law, is essentially kind of fixing some of the holes in it. In theory.
So, Petra, under those guidelines of reasonable steps, is anyone thinking that the social media platforms have been doing this? Have steps been taken?
Well, there was a pretty interesting and enlightening University of Newcastle study, I think, last week, where they followed more than 400 teens throughout this process. And basically they found that I think something like 86% were still using social media after the ban, like months after the ban came into force. And most of them, more than half of them, were actually still using their own accounts. Not all of them had any kind of like age verification checks. There were some, but a lot of those were just like asking them what their age was or asking for a selfie, which doesn't feel too hard to get past. And also they found that most of the teens weren't kind of changing their behaviour, so still using social media, same platforms, roughly the same time. Didn't feel like a great sense that the laws were working just yet.
The government must have been pretty excited that this study came out last week, in the sense that it kind of gave the exact reason why they would enact the bill that they're now pushing, which, as you say, is to double the penalties. A lot of the government will say around 5 million fewer kids in Australia are using social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snap. But yes, the findings of that study was that many of these extremely, extremely lucrative platforms, who you know have the money to implement a lot of what's needed, have not been doing even the most kind of rudimentary things. So there's been a lot of technology piloted in terms of, like Petra mentioned, kind of selfies to verify your age. And though there are some problems with those, it's not even clear that they've been using those. It's not even been clear that they've been doing something beyond the most basic, like, hey, are you 16? And you write 17 and they're like, cool, seems good with me.
Those 5 million fewer accounts, they could have been owned by even less people.
Yeah.
It's not even individuals that we're counting at this stage, is it?
Yeah, exactly. And they could have been the same people across different accounts and so on and so forth. So, you know, it hasn't been a complete loss, but I think the really important thing is not necessarily the doubling of the fine. So the fine goes from, the maximum penalty goes from $49 million to $99 million. For reference, Meta made at least $1.7 billion in revenue in Australia last year. And that's what they reported, and that doesn't encapsulate their full business here. So, you know, their Australian business is not a nothing figure for them. 99 million, not the most. But the really important change here is that the eSafety Commissioner can investigate them and kind of hold them to account. So before it was kind of a self, you know, they would, self-policing, I guess you would say, you know, they would proffer information to the authorities and be like, you know, this is what we're doing. It's working pretty well, we think. Whereas now the eSafety Commission, which is kind of Australia's internet regulator, can, you know, give them a call and say, hey, this person got in, what's happening here exactly? Show me precisely what you're doing to stop this.
And presumably they could just hand over a piece of paper saying we're asking people how old they are. Yeah. But Petra, do we think that the social media companies are likely to comply with these bans, with the new rules that are coming in? Is the threat of the fines enough?
Well, it seems like the government thinks that maybe there wasn't a high enough penalty to begin with. I think we'll really have to wait and see. I mean, it's been actually such a short amount of time since these laws have been introduced. But maybe they'll have greater incentive to actually comply. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of countries that are also looking at doing something similar to what Australia is doing. So if there's, you know, if the UK joins in as expected, France, Denmark, Canada, if this starts to become a broader thing, maybe there'll be a greater incentive for the platforms just purely by, you know, the greater number of users involved to actually do something.
That's a really important point. And I think part of why it's important that the government ratchet up the penalties, but also have a regulator that can specifically investigate them, hold them to account, is because it's very much in Meta and the other companies' interest to make it look ineffective. Because, as Petra said, there is going to be bills going through in all these countries, you know, Brazil, Canada, the UK, etc. And it is very helpful for Meta's lobbyists, and I'm saying Meta, but it also encapsulates, you know, TikTok, Snapchat, Google, because of YouTube. It's very helpful for them to say, like, oh, look, Australia tried it and, you know, it only did this and it did that. It's not really effective. Maybe we want to go another way. So it is, yeah, like I say, in their benefit to make it look ineffective for now, if that makes sense.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. And as we use technology more and more in our everyday lives, you know, be it in business or households or data centres, there's one obvious impact that's happening, and it's showing up on our power bills. Petra Stock, most of us have seen our power bills go up. Why is that a surprise to us?
Yeah, I have been looking at this issue recently at The Guardian, and I would, I guess, preface what I'm going to say by just explaining that the energy market, and in particular like the retail market, which is what most of us interact with, is just so incredibly complex. So it's actually quite challenging to work out what energy bills are doing as a whole.
So it's not just us. It's intentionally designed this way.
It's so complicated. It's complicated for people to navigate, even just to find like the best bill for them. But it's also complicated for journalists like me, even people who know a bit about the energy system, to try and explain. But I guess one of the reasons people expected to start seeing their bills going down is it's because something politicians have been talking about quite a lot. And recently we did have the Australian Energy Regulator make this decision about this sort of very terribly named product called the default market offer, which is basically kind of like a standing electricity plan that is sort of a safety net, sort of a benchmark price. Most people aren't on the default offer, but that's probably getting a bit much in the weeds. But what they said was that in the next year, from 1 July, people should expect people on those plans should expect their bills to be going down broadly. There were some small kind of carve-outs, a small rise in South Australia. But what people heard following that decision was that power bills were going to fall because wind, solar and batteries were reducing volatility in the energy system and also displacing our reliance on expensive gas. So the expectation was that power bills would go down. Now, coming up to July, a lot of people start getting things in the mail from their electricity provider by email, notices saying that, you know, this is how your bill is going to change post 1 July. And a lot of people were seeing that there were what looked like increases for things like supply charges. So the charge of supplying electricity to your house rather than, you know, how much you're using.
Right. So not the parts we can control.
That's right. So for a lot of people, and it is quite hard to say how many, were getting these notices that their bills were going to go up. So they were hearing that bills were going to go down and then getting a notice indicating to them that that wasn't happening. I would say, anytime we ask regulators or experts about this, the consistent message is if you see that your electricity bill is going up, what you need to do, which is, you know, a very exhausting thing to be told to do, but basically you need to shop around, you need to look at government sites that let you compare bills and find a better one. More times than not, you will be able to find, a different electricity plan that will be a lot cheaper. But, you know, for some reason, the system requires us to go through this process on a regular basis of looking around.
It really doesn't seem fair, does it?
It's your fault, Ray. It's your fault for not looking hard enough.
But it shouldn't be my fault, you know. We should be able to have a system that even allows us to more easily choose a cheaper provider. It feels intentionally set up in a way to get us lost and caught in the weeds somehow. It's tricky to navigate.
It's so incredible. I was reading an ACCC report that was from December last year, and in that they were saying nationwide there's something like 145,000 different electricity plans or variants of offers.
So 145,000 different plans or offers for us to choose from as individuals. We're supposed to shop around in this way.
So in a given state, there might be thousands of different, you know, potential choices. It's so complex. Not like your water bill, which, you know, for the most part is just like one provider, you don't need to know anything about it, and this is the water charge. It's really in that this is a market. We expect people to shop around and choose. And often it will penalise the people who aren't doing that.
I suppose it's very much built into the business models of a lot of the energy providers, right, that they're essentially assuming people won't shop around because they don't. I mean, I'm extremely guilty of this. Like every quarter, just like, wow, what's the deal with this? Oh, well, you know.
And I suppose then you've got the people that want to kind of step outside of that system entirely and look at generating their own power, you know, be it through household solar. I've noticed a lot of people in my neighbourhood installing batteries a lot more. Yeah, what kind of steps can we take in that regard, Petra? Is that becoming a better option for people?
Yeah, I guess. And what's happening on that consumer side, you know, the huge up, you know, Australians are huge technology adopters when it comes to these kind of home energy gizmos. Like something like 4.3 million homes now have solar panels. The government's battery subsidy has seen a huge uptick in people adding batteries. I think there's something like 600,000 of those. So that's kind of adding to that complexity too, and adding to the expectation that we in homes are going to be kind of proactively managing the way we use electricity. And I think really the people who are doing that really are benefiting. And there are a bunch of, you know, retail plans that are kind of selling themselves to people who have home batteries or have solar or have an EV, So people who have the energy and appetite to be doing those things are really getting a lot of value out of it. And like people we've spoken to for recent stories are saving, you know, hundreds of dollars, sometimes self-sufficient in their own power, but not everyone can or has the willingness to do that. And we do know also that it's mainly people who own their own homes. So I think something like 44% of owner-occupiers now have solar, but the amount in renters is something like 11%. So there's a discrepancy there in who's winning under this hugely complicated system and who's missing out on some of those benefits.
And then, of course, you've got a lot of people who can't control their power supply at all. I know that I've lived in a rental property before where we had to sign up with a specific electricity supplier. You didn't get a choice. One of the biggest conversations around energy consumption at the moment is also surrounding data centres. You know, we've got quite a few data centres that have already been approved to be built in New South Wales. It does look as though future data centres will be asked to bring their own power supply or power themselves. Petra, we've spoken about this at length before. Where are we at now? Is the future looking a little bit brighter in this sense?
Yeah, I mean, we have spoken about just how much energy and sometimes water data centres do use and how much that's expected to grow. And, you know, within 5 years, it's likely going to double, according to the Australian Energy Operator. I think there's been a lot of noise about this, and we are starting to see governments kind of pay attention to that. You know, there was a set of expectations earlier in the year that the federal government put out that said, you know, we, you know, the sort of we'd like to see data centres using recycled water instead of potable water for their cooling, things like that. But they're getting a bit more organised, and in May, actually, state and federal energy ministers, with the exception of Queensland, I think, basically agreed that data centres should be required to fully offset their electricity demand through new investments in renewable energy and energy storage. I think we're a bit yet to see how that's really going to play out, but I think that is a sign that governments are taking this issue seriously.
You are listening to Download the Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. And in what's being called the token apocalypse, after encouraging everyone to use it as much as possible, all sorts of companies are now telling employees to cut back on their AI usage. We are hearing tokens being spoken about a lot lately. Daniel, in this context, what is a token?
Every word that ChatGPT gives you is a few tokens. And every mathematical equation is many, many more tokens. And so essentially, it's the best way to gauge AI use. Now, a way to think about this is there's three kind of tiers of AI payment. So most people use free GPT, or, you know, like you can use Claude, Gemini, or ChatGPT for free. For, you know, you can ask a few questions a day, and most, I think 90% of people do that. Then you can pay either $30 or $300, depending on, you know, how intense you want to go as a consumer. And then at an enterprise level, if you're a big bank or something, you get charged by consumption per tokens used. Now, tokens have gotten much, much, much more expensive in the last few years for two reasons. Firstly, because the AI models themselves are getting potentially too powerful, as in, you know, you don't need a Ferrari to drive down the road kind of thing. Like, you're asking the most powerful model in the world to turn an email into a slide deck or something like that. But secondly, data centers take years and years to build, or years and years to get approval for, and then years to build. Because all these companies have been encouraging every employee in the company to use AI, there's a mismatch, and the result of that is enormous costs.
Petra, what impact will having to pay for AI usage have? What's happening already?
Well, it's pretty, you know, it seems like the impact of this, even kind of giving AI use some sort of metric in these tokens, and then companies realizing what it's costing them is having a pretty almost immediate impact. I mean, it's everyone from, you know, big tech companies like Uber in the US, but also, you know, even Westpac here in Australia. They've started realizing this is costing quite a bit of money, and maybe we don't want our employees using it for all kinds of things. Maybe we just want to limit its use to things that will, you know, actually improve productivity, you know, rather than, you know, those sort of frivolous uses like, you know, creating slide decks with silly AI generated pictures.
I think that there was a bit of a perception that these tools would be utilized by, say, software engineers within these organizations to create products that could generate some type of return on investment for the organization. Has anyone reported a return on investment from something they've made with AI tools?
Funny you should say that, because I was at a CommBank conference last month, which at which Sam Altman, the founder of OpenAI, was a speaker. Dialing in from San Francisco, of course. And the last question that was asked of him was like, oh, what do CEOs say when they speak to you? And he said, which is, I still don't know why he said this, but he said, you know, all the CEOs I speak to keep telling me they're spending a lot on AI, but they're not seeing a productivity return yet. When are we going to see the productivity? And I think we just got to be patient, which is, you know, like.
This is famously the man who, when asked about his own company, how will you make OpenAI profitable, he said artificial general intelligence will be able to answer that for us when we achieve
Perfect.
It.
Perfect. Done. A job well done. I think that the Uber CTO at a conference last month, also I don't know why he said this, but he revealed that the company had a yearly budget for AI and it blew through it in 4 months.
Yes.
So, yeah, like, you know, that's obviously not good.
Petra, why does generative AI cost so much? Where is the money going?
Ketan Joshi, who's a climate analyst who's been tracking this issue, he said that most technology companies are now reporting accelerating power consumption basically year on year. And the intensity of their energy use is basically going up, you know, whether you're measuring it per active user, per unit of revenue, everything is going up compared to, say, 5 years ago. So they're using way more energy for one thing, but they're not necessarily serving more people or making more money. So that is definitely one of the reasons, but, you know, I'm not sure it's the full picture.
I would also add that the input costs for data centers are ballooning. For the type of data center that AI requires, you need GPUs. So right off the bat, you know, NVIDIA, they're essentially the only company in the world that can make these chips that AI companies need to train their models. Then there's a company like Micron, a quick staggering statistic for you. Micron's profit year on year is up 1,400%. Because they are one of a very few amount of companies that can make this type of memory, which data centers need. And you can't really scale up production that fast, so they can just kind of name their price, and Meta and Google and Amazon and the like will pay for it. So there's a lot of competition for a finite amount of, you know, GPUs, memory, storage, etc. Which, by the way, is why iPhones will be more expensive this year.
Everything's more expensive. That's why the Apple website went down recently and came back up, and everything was $200 to $300 more. You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Daniel Van Boom and Petra Stock. And Petra, before we go, I'd love to hear of any tech that has brought you joy this week.
Well, I had to think quite hard about this because, if I'm honest, quite a lot of the stuff that brings me joy is kind of in the analog sphere. But, you know, I thought about it. I did recently have some fun. You know, I'm a late adopter of music streaming, and I did recently have some fun creating a playlist on an internet music platform with songs from a book that I was reading, Rachel Kushner's The Flamethrower. For some reason in this book there were lots of songs referred to, so I thought, oh, I'm gonna put this together and see what it's like.
Make it a multimedia experience while you're reading. That's fantastic. And do you listen to the playlist while you read? Have you tried to do that?
I have tried to do that. you know, it was a fun thing to do. Not sure if anyone else is ever going to listen to that playlist, but it's there. I thought about doing one for one of her other books called Creation Lake, but that would need to be a redacted list, I think.
There we go.
Some unsavory tunes in that one.
And Daniel Van Boom, what tech has brought you joy this week?
I unfortunately have to do a cop-out answer because I did rack my brain very hard and I could come up with exactly zero, you know, joyous moments from tech. But I do have a cop-out answer.
Okay.
A tech company that has brought me joy.
Fair enough.
Through
Bring line it on.
Of this show, things are getting more expensive, Ray.
Yep.
Good guy Nintendo gave all their staff in Japan a 10% pay rise this week.
Oh, bless.
Because inflation is going up in Japan. So good for them. That made me feel good. Me feel good about owning a Switch too.
Fantastic. We're scraping the bottom of the barrel here for tech that's brought you joy on Download This Show. Daniel, thank you again for joining us. Where can people find you on your work?
Forbes.com.au.
Fantastic. And Petra, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you and your work?
Mostly on The Guardian.
Fantastic. Thank you both so much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And some more tech news from the week that was. In case you missed it, the ACCC is taking Amazon to federal court over its Prime subscriptions. It says Amazon used 5 unfair contract terms that let it change the service without warning and used those terms to add ads to Prime Video in July 2024, after more than 1 million people had already paid for a year of ad-free viewing. It is one of the first big tests of new laws that punish companies for unfair contract terms. Meta now limits a hearing feature on its smart glasses, called Conversation Focus, which makes it easier to hear someone talking in a noisy room. Free users get 3 hours a month, and people who pay $20 a month for Meta One Premium get 15 hours. The feature runs entirely on the glasses and does not use Meta's servers, so it costs Meta nothing extra when people use it. Meta says most people will not hit the free limit, but disability advocates are unhappy since many people rely on the feature to hear better. And in Queensland, farmers are trialling drones to help muster cattle on remote stations. The goal is to take some pressure off station workers during a busy and physically demanding job, not to replace them. Workers still make the key decisions, with the drones helping move the cattle. And that's all for this week on Download This Show. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And we do love hearing all of your thoughts and your feedback, so send it over to downloadthisshow@abc.net.au. Or you can slide into my DMs on Instagram @RayJohnston. Let me know if you're using drones in your life. I want to hear how you are utilising them. A big thanks to my producer, Jessie Kay. This episode was produced on the lands of the Gadigal, Barramadigal, Darug, Gundungurra and Wurundjeri peoples. I'm Ray Johnston and you've been listening to Download This Show.